Today, we mark the 100th anniversary of the first women who enrolled at Michigan State. And pay tribute to the contributions Michigan State alumni have made over the years. This is in keeping with efforts underway here and around the country to assure equal status, educational, and employment opportunities for women. Our commencement speaker today personifies the kind of role women can play in our society, both now and in the future. She is no newcomer to the national scene, having spent a lifetime in public service, and she has been recognized for years as an expert in both labor and consumer affairs. Few individuals, and even fewer women, are granted the privilege of serving the President of the United States. Yet our commencement speaker has served presidents in a variety of capacities from 1961 to 1969. She was first appointed director of the Women's Bureau in the Department of Labor by President Kennedy, and she concurrently served as Assistant Secretary of Labor for Labor Standards. One of her major accomplishments in those years was steering through Congress the Equal Pay for Equal Work legislation in 1963. She also served on the President's Commission on the Status of Women in the early 60s. Later, she became a special assistant to President Johnson for Consumer Affairs and served as chairman of the President's Committee on Consumer Interests. Presently, she is the Washington representative for the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America. I might add, she is the wife of a professor of international labor studies at American University and the mother of four children. Our speaker has a long and distinguished record in governmental service and is deeply respected for her long and devoted interests in labor, in the status of women, and in consumer affairs. It is my pleasure and honor to introduce the second woman in the history of Michigan State to deliver a commencement address, Mrs. Esther Peterson.
Thank you, thank you. I would like to say I hope he writes my obituary. I might make it. We've come a long way.
Well,
I'm grateful for the opportunity today, President Wharton, to be able to address the students, the graduates, the parents, and the faculty. And I'm so honored to be here at this great and innovative institution. I address you for what most students, and I hope you still consider, one of the great milestones of life, your graduation, for I believe truly that it is. Your generation students has already been damned and praised so much that the burden must be becoming intolerable. There are those who are certain you will wipe out the ills of thousands of years in 20, and there are still others who swear you are the final step in our road to total ruin and collapse. But there are those of us who have been working through the years to change the world. We've been at it all our lives, and we welcome you as brothers and sisters in arms, and we're not handing you all the world's problems to serve alone. You have made an impact even before graduation. You have already begun to mold and shape your world for better or for worse, and I am one who knows and believes it is for the better. Today, I want to talk to you of some ideas for action that will unite us, the old and the young, the doers, in an effective political alliance. There are those on some campuses, I'm sure, that there are some that exist here at MSU, who are convinced that the system must fail because there is no opportunity for change. But I would like to point out that I share the platform today with a great lady who knows that her creative genius and her artistry once was not enough to earn her the stage of Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C. But with dignity and grandeur, Marian Anderson sang instead at the nation's great Lincoln Memorial, and in one glorious instant, which I shall never forget, shamed the people and shamed the nation for its racism and brought pride to her people. She knows that there can be change. And another great lady, Jane Addams, who this university honored years ago, she overcame Victorian complacency of her class and made common cause with the poor. And questions that Jane Addams asked as a student are as contemporary as today's underground paper. She wrote of their irrelevancy of much of the education of her day and said, "We spend so much time in preparation, we have no time for experience." And she told of young educated women hearing constantly of social maladjustments but being given no way to effect change. And she said, "Their uselessness hangs heavily about them." And as I look around today, I am glad to say that that is rapidly changing. Those who think the system cannot respond to change regard the terrible tragedies at Kent State and Jackson State as irreparable losses. Let me remind you that this is not the first time that dissenters have lost their lives in this nation. We in the labor movement have also engaged the enemy and lost. When I heard the stories of the Jackson State students who met with us in Washington last week, I was moved and reminded of the testimony of a striker from 1910. She said, and I quote, "I see Charlie out there walking in the line. Up comes a foreman, gives him a punch and yells, 'Go home, troublemaker.' And Charlie," he says, "I got my rights." And then there was this sort of little scuffle. And then I heard the shot, people running, and Charlie lying there, his blood spreading out across the snow. Rights they gave him, a bullet in the head they gave him." These clothing workers were dissenting from the law of the land, from the courts, and from the society of our elected representatives. And in the dissent, there was violence, blood was shed, and lives were lost. But violence was never our tactic. It happened despite our best aim to be nonviolent. The sit-down strikers in auto, rubber, and textile plants were peaceful. I know because I was there. As an organizer, I passed food through the windows of the textile mills in New Bedford, Massachusetts. And as the workers reached their arms outside with food, they sang, "We shall not be moved." But often they were, by the force of arms. We believed that the democratic institutions of this country could respond to political pressure. We proved to be right. And in a short time, the law, the courts, and a majority of the people were supporting us in a movement that brought more economic progress in 30 years than there had been in 300 years that preceded. The same alliance of working people, students, liberals, blacks, and all minorities, and small farmers can once again bring about social change. But if the alliance is to work, we must reject the tactic of violence. Revolution without program is not the door to progressive change. It is the door to fascism and repression and hideous civil war. We know that the veneer of civilization that protects us from our most primitive drives is very thin, and how quickly it can be stripped away in the atmosphere of war. This alliance can bring about change, and it must, for our nation is faced with so many tragic divisions and is so undermined by internal crises that some might fear for its existence, were it not that we have so many basic strengths, and those strengths among those great strengths is you. Not the least of these crises is the crisis of leadership. We have already been so horribly robbed of some of our greatest leaders by natural death and accident and the assassin's bullet. Only last month, one of Michigan's finest citizens and a close friend of this university perished in an airplane crash. The death of Walter Reuther robbed the labor movement of a moral leader, but even more tragically, it robbed the nation of a visionary who was practical. Walter believed that the divisions could be healed and must be healed. He believed in the alliance. I have no doubt that your generation will produce replacements for these voices of conscience. But at the moment, we are bereft. We miss the voices of Martin Luther King and of the Kennedys. Crisis has become a part of our world today. Technology has created another, but it is also a wonderful gift. 90% of all the scientists who were ever engaged in research are working today. Knowledge of the physical world could more than double in the coming decade. Some see this as so evil, so filled with the potential to disrupt and to destroy the human race, that they turn away from technology and reject its fruits. The crisis, however, is not too much technology, but it's too little for too few. We needn't reject the constructive products of this age of plenty. Rather, conscience demands that they be extended to every living soul in our nation and throughout the world. We must divert the technological genius now involved in defense research to the peacetime sector. It took far too long to develop a high-protein fish flour because too little of our national purpose was dedicated to feeding the hungry. We must pay chemists more to develop nutritious foods than we pay them to develop napalm. We must pay engineers more to design mass transit systems than we pay to develop moonships. We must instill workers with the same sense of national purpose in rebuilding our cities as we do to develop the space program. We must reorder our priorities, and we need the alliance to do it. In Washington, D.C., in an area that is poor, that is black, that is a ghetto with inadequate social facilities, there has been proposed a new town within a city, Fort Lincoln. It would have fine schools, good shopping, parks, recreation, and housing for many different kinds of people. But Fort Lincoln's plans are still no further than the drawing board because we don't care enough. Fort Lincoln will cost approximately $175 million. Is that too much? Consider this formula. The cost of 1 year of the war in Southeast Asia in 1969 was $29,800,000, which is equal to 436 Fort Lincolns, or housing, schools, and other community facilities for 7,194,000 people. The goal of the coalition can be a society with rational priorities, one plan for people, not for profits. There is room for some people to be richer than others. There is room for reasonable profits, but there is no room for people to be hopelessly poor. There is no room for people to be malnourished, unemployed, homeless, lonely, and forgotten. There is no room for the production of weapons that overkill and overkill without reason, while people go without housing, schools, and hospitals, transportation, and decent medical care. We can produce millions of units of anything we want, but instead of producing houses, we produce missile silos. How ironic it is that our manufacturers find it profitable to produce the symbols of rebellion at a price while they agonize over the moral decay of our sons and daughters. So now the casual dress, which began as a rejection of fashion, can be purchased at high prices in fashionable boutiques. We must challenge the Madison Avenue techniques that make us do what they want us to do. And what could be a better example of the waste of our system than most recent marketing marvel, the feminine spray? There is an example of advertising creating a demand for a product that never existed, and no one asked for it and no one missed. And what could be more dishonest than advertising a slogans that links its exploitation of insecurity and feminine dependency to a movement for women's economic rights? But sad to say, this new product is a hot seller, and advertising men sanctimoniously answer our outraged criticisms by saying, there must have been a need. Look how people are buying the products, as if we no longer had any soap and water. So don't blame only the capitalism or Madison Avenue or the industrial military complex. The public responds to the stimulus all too well and all too willingly, and we don't even know sometimes that we've been had. Youth is rightfully repelled by this nation's uneven affluence, horrified by what seems to be their parents' constant drive for financial security, and much of middle-aged America sees its youth with a mixture of pride and resentment. You are the most beautiful, the most mobile, and independent than we have ever dreamed of being. And when you reject work and choose to dress in what way to some looks like derelict clothes, those who have worked hard all their lives must continue to work are understandably questioned and repelled. You do not see that although you reject the marks of affluence, you have an ease with our technology that we never had. Fast cars, instant meals, plastic furniture, long-distance telephoning, portable radios, cross-country jet flights, all these come naturally to you. And as we observe, and some people cluck their tongues over this paradoxical behavior, we do not see how we, our generation, our standards have become. We do not see how warped they have become. We've accepted suburban ghettos. Our work has often lost its meaning, and much of entertainment is banal and insipid. And worst of all, so many of our personal relationships are empty. But the solution we seek are not only within ourselves, they are political. Our generational differences can be healed in this alliance, and to do it, we must embark on a moral crusade, and we must end an immoral war. We must wage the fight against racism, and we must end the war in Indochina. We must start where we left off all too abruptly. We must once again raise the call for an integrated society. Integration is not a matter of style or tactic. It is an irrefutable goal of our nation. Black and white, all human beings, we must once again fearlessly lock arms against those who would divide us. Black separatists and white parlor radicals who support them are doing a good job for Wallace and Senator Eastland. I am convinced that if you believe in segregated dormitories, separate faculties, segregated cafeterias, segregated schools, separate programs of education, that you're copping out. The only black tradition you will recapture is the tradition of slavery and the ghetto and unemployment. Separatism will deny our world some of its finest citizens, those filled with a driving ambition to change the world. We need them. Without them in the alliance, we cannot win. And we cannot change, and we must end this war. It has sapped our national energies and used our resources and destroyed our ability to do the most important thing of all, to communicate, to hear, and to listen to each other. I believe that this is a generation that would defend democracy were it believed democracy to be threatened. I do believe that we are a unique group in the history of man, and that so large a segment of our nation has told our government, we do not believe in this war. We will not serve in this war. This war dishonors us. But it will take more than the issue of war and peace to build our alliance. It would be tragic if this turned out to be a one-issue generation. For what would happen if a man on a white horse offered to end the war tomorrow? Would you respond? It is good that the student protest movement is turning its eyes toward Capitol Hill, for there is the decision-making body of our land, and there the tools of change can be enacted. I have been shocked by the number of students who have come to Washington who have no idea of how a bill becomes law, or do not understand the political process, and some who do not even know who their congressman is. And those, so many of them, who confuse political give and take with gutless compromise. I am afraid that they are guilty of an elitism that denies the variety of ideas within our nation. Not everyone agrees that there should be a national health plan or occupational health and safety standards or a guaranteed income or even food for all, even if I do. But then, when there are 10,000 lobbyists for the special interests to about a proportion of 10 for the public interest, to whom shall the Congress respond? It is up to you to join the battle. Walking the halls of Congress isn't enough. Organize the precincts, run for office, and most of all, support those people who have made public service and politics an honest and honored profession. And may I say that here in Michigan, you have such a man in the name of Senator Phil Hart. And there is not a single institution within our society that does not provide specific points of entry for those who challenge it. Ralph Nader was aided in his drive against the automobile industry by the United States Senate and the Congress. They offered him a platform to investigate and air his charges. He, more probably than any other individual, has been responsible for bringing corporations to recognize their social as well as their corporate responsibility. I have no doubt that in a very short time there will be consumer representatives on the boards of many major corporations of the nation. The tawdriness of the marketplace is an issue like the war, like unemployment, which is again beginning to haunt us, and especially so many of our graduates that are now looking for meaningful jobs. Unemployment, like racism, and the marketplace. These are all issues, and you will have to look at the record of candidates on these and many issues, as well as the issue of war and peace. You know the peace movement has been willing to forgive the aims, the sins of some of its friends. It accepts the poor civil rights record of a Senator Fulbright as a regional aberration, and you'll have to exert the same judgment on other candidates. You can't win them all. Sometimes you will be leading a fight against a bad guy instead of for a good guy. There are some in Congress, for example, to whom seniority has given more power than they ought to have, and they use that power to thwart social progress and to corrupt the national goals. We may have to support the campaign of someone we don't agree with, even if it means defeating a bad candidate with seniority, a Mendel Rivers or a Senator Stennis. And while the system may have lost its luster to those who have free access to it, there are still too many in our nation who are on the outside looking in. And we have no right to deny them their opportunity to participate. The Voting Rights Act of 1965, I believe to be the most effective piece of civil rights legislation ever passed by Congress. And that act is due to expire in August. Since its passage in five states where federal examiners have been appointed, Negro registration has jumped from 29 to 52%. In those states covered by the act, more than 800,000 Negro citizens have been registered, and the number of black elected officials has grown from 78 to nearly 500. People left out are coming in. The next week, the House will vote on a Senate-passed bill in the form of a resolution to extend the Voting Rights Act. It is only seven lines, but those seven lines are needed to make our coalition work both north and south. If it does not pass, tens of thousands of Americans will lack the power to vote next November. Have you written your congressman to support this piece of legislation? Look at our institutions with a critical eye and consider these things. If our courts dysfunction and provide unequal justice, that it is not because they are not free, that it is because our society is imperfect. If our trade unions are sluggish, that is not because they are monolithic and totalitarian. It is because the members and the leadership are also part of this imperfect society. Are our newspapers, organizations, and associations unresponsive to us? We can change them. The tools were given us by a group of revolutionaries 200 years ago in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. They have been valued weapons in the past, and they still are. I have no doubt that amidst the tumult and the disruption on the campuses, there are thousands of youth who are doggedly pursuing career goals, and that's right, and I'm not knocking it. For needed today so greatly is the intellectual discipline and training that you have been pursuing here. There is no substitute for it. Knowledge is more valuable than it ever was, but we need you in the mainstream. We don't want the dreamers to be off on a permanent trip. We want the dreamers, the planners, the trained, and the disciplined to be in the mainstream and to advance the vision of the world. Drive and emotion are not enough, and we want and need the women too. Not separate from men, but joined as fellow human beings. I am a woman who's pursued a career to a high-level post in the government. I have also four children and two grandchildren, you didn't say. And I have followed my husband when his work made it necessary. I have felt deep resentment at the obvious discriminations that women face on the job market and home and in society, and I've done my best to see that these discriminations are eliminated. But I have sought fulfillment, too, in some womanly achievements. Homemaking, offering husband and children a sense of well-being, order, and sanity, can be dignified and satisfying, but it must be accomplished in an atmosphere of deep respect, of sharing, and of love, raising strong sons and daughters, happy, secure, and able to cope, is rewarding beyond description. I want you to challenge economic and social discrimination against women, and I will be your strongest ally, but I want you to cherish some of our unique femaleness and to bring it with you into the political arena. Above all, let's remember that change is really the only thing we're sure of. If change becomes violent, everything is destroyed, the good as well as the evil. And no one knows what will be built in the place of that which is destroyed. I believe we will choose the way of social progress, and you and from you must come the leadership to bring it about, the moral leadership that is needed. I like the way the American author James Baldwin expressed it when he said, "For nothing is fixed. Forever and forever and forever, it is not fixed. The earth is always shifting. The light is always changing. The sea does not cease to grind down rock. Generations do not cease to be born. And we are responsible to them because we are the only witnesses they have. The sea rises, the light fails, lovers cling to each other, and children cling to us. The moment we cease to hold each other, the moment we break faith with one another, the sea engulfs us and the light goes out. And I know that you graduates and you students will never allow the light to go out."
Thank you very much, Mrs. Peterson, for that thoughtful message.